Trump says he can pardon himself. Democrats avoid a top two sentence in California. And a new book on baseball and politics is right over the plate. Let's play three on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. In California, the Democrats' fears about getting shut out from key House races turned out to be unfounded. Will the party get a boost for November?
The turnout in the primary is very different from the turnout in the general. The fall turnout is going to be younger and more people of color voting, more Latinos, and so that should favor Democrats.
Plus, we'll explore the intersection between national politics and the national pastime.
General George Washington at Valley Forge played baseball, that is, rounders, which was a British antecedent of the game, Abraham Lincoln. There are many records of him playing town ball, a derivative of baseball.
And on this 50-year anniversary of Bobby Kennedy's death, we'll revisit the emotional scene of his burial at Arlington National Cemetery.
I remember so vividly the brilliant colors of the flag-draped coffin, which were hyper-illuminated by these TV lights. And the hearse pulled up, and everybody got out, and we just stood there.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 232 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Tuesday was the biggest primary day of the year so far, with voters in eight states going to the polls. We'll have a separate report on California coming up, but here's what we know so far in the other states. New Jersey hasn't elected a Republican to the Senate since 1972, and the odds say that this year won't be any different. But incumbent Senator Robert Menendez, under fire over ethics questions, saw 38% of the vote in the Democratic primary go to a completely unknown challenger, Lisa McCormick, who had no money, no TV ads, basically no campaign to speak of. Meanwhile, the Republican nomination was easily captured by Bob Hugin, a former biotech chief executive. The general election in November will be worth watching, as a recent poll by Fairleigh Dickinson University had Hugin trailing Menendez by only 4 points. In Montana, Republicans nominated Matt Rosendale, the state auditor, to take on Democratic Senator John Tester in November. Rosendale had been the favorite, but his margin of victory was closer than expected, securing just 34% of the vote in a four-candidate field, just 5 percentage points higher than his closest rival. Tester is in the crosshairs of President Trump, who blames the senator for torpedoing the nomination of Ronnie Jackson to be his Veterans Affairs Secretary. The race in November will certainly be a beaut. Two female Republican governors who recently ascended to office were renominated on Tuesday. Kay Ivey in Alabama, whose predecessor resigned due to scandal, and Kim Reynolds in Iowa, where previous Governor Terry Branstad left to become ambassador to China. In South Dakota, Kristi Noem hopes to join the group of female Republican governors. Noem, the at-large member of Congress from the Mount Rushmore state, won the GOP primary to succeed the incumbent, who is term-limited, and she's the favorite to win in November. South Dakota has never had a female governor. And a Democratic woman, Representative Michelle Lujan Grisham, won her party's nomination for governor of New Mexico. If she wins in November, she would succeed another woman, Republican Susana Martinez, who is term limited. Back in Alabama, another Republican woman seeking renomination, Congresswoman Martha Roby in the state's 2nd District, failed to receive a majority of the vote and was forced into a July runoff. Her opponent is Bobby Bright, a former Democratic congressman whom she ousted in 2010. But he switched to the GOP and is trying to capitalize on the anger some Republican voters have for Roby after she broke with Donald Trump over the Access Hollywood tape in 2016.
It became clear to me that I could no longer justify a vote
for Donald Trump. This disgusting behavior, this boasting and admittance of grabbing women's private parts was enough for me. And so I felt that it was very important to step forward and be honest with my constituency. And I felt once that video came out, that the way we were going to win, the way we were going to move forward, was to tell Mr. Trump that he needs to step aside. And so that was my position then. That, of course, is my position now. I want to win this White House. I do not want Hillary Clinton to be president of the United States. But I cannot look my children in the eye, Margaret and George, and justify a vote for a man who promotes and boasts about sexually assaulting women.
Roby has been in hot water ever since with voters who remain loyal to the president. Of course, during his one term as a Democratic congressman, Bright voted for Nancy Pelosi to be Speaker of the House. The runoff will be on July 17th. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last female member of Congress to lose her seat in a primary? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Martha, my dear, you have always been my inspiration. Please be good to me. Martha, my love, don't forget me. Martha, my dear.
There was a widespread narrative going into Tuesday's California primary. Because the state had adopted what is called a top two primary system, in which all candidates, regardless of party, run on the same ballot, and the top two finishers, regardless of party, advance to November, some thought that a plethora of Democratic candidates in races for key congressional seats would result in the party splitting its votes and thus getting shut out for the November runoff. While votes are still being counted, it doesn't look like that happened. That, and the race to succeed the term-limited Governor Jerry Brown, highlighted Tuesday's primaries in the Golden State. Here to make sense of it all is Scott Schaefer, the senior politics and government editor at radio station KQED in San Francisco. Scott, welcome back to the Political Junkie, and thanks for coming in on what had to be a very long night.
Yeah, very long, and it's going to be a long day perhaps as well, but good to be with you.
Well, I really appreciate it more than you know, and I'm excited that you're here. And so tell me, you know, looking back now, what were you looking at, what were you most looking at in Tuesday's primaries?
Well, I think up and down the ballot, there were questions, as you suggested, about how the top two primary system would play out. Republicans' nightmare was that it would play out with two Democrats finishing first and second in the race for governor, and then they would have been shut out of that office. And with no presidential election this year and no Republican running for the Senate, Republicans were concerned that Republican voters wouldn't turn out in the fall, which would hurt some of those Republican congressional districts that Democrats are targeting. That didn't happen. John Cox, with help from Donald Trump, managed to come in second, so it'll be him against the first place finisher, the Democrat, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. And then on the Democratic side, as you suggested, there were real concerns that Democrats would get shut out of some of these races. And while there is one race, the 48th Congressional District, where Dana Rohrabacher is the incumbent, there is a chance still that a Republican could come in second, but it doesn't look likely. So both parties on Tuesday night managed to avoid their worst case scenario.
Well, when you talk about what Democrats are hoping for in 2018 in the midterms, obviously it's recapturing control of the House, and nowhere better were their chances thought to be than in California, where there are at least seven districts held by Republicans, perhaps vulnerable Republicans, and seats that Hillary Clinton carried in 2016. So that gave the Democrats some momentum. But as you were saying, I wrote down here, there were at least three districts. The 39th, where Republican Ed Royce was retiring. The 48th, where you mentioned Dana Rohrabacher, looks very vulnerable. And the 49th, where Republican Daryl Issa is leaving. Democrats were concerned and worried that with all their excitement, with all their enthusiasm, and with all their candidates, There would be so many candidates that they would split the vote and allow two Republicans to advance. But as you say, it doesn't look like that happened.
Yeah, I think what happened was that before Issa and Ed Royce announced they were retiring, there was just an assumption that you'd have one Republican, the incumbent, and then one Democrat. So a lot of Democrats jumped into those races. And as you said, the party, the DCCC, was very concerned that they would divide up the pie in so many pieces that it would allow some of the better-known Republicans in those districts to sneak through to that second-place spot. But the DCCC really thread the needle on this one, Ken. They put their thumb on the scale for some of their favored Democratic candidates in those districts, and that seemed to have helped. And they ran ads against some of the Republicans that they were worried about coming in second to kind of bring their totals down. Now, how much of an impact that had, I don't know, but they did get the outcome that they were looking for.
Well, I read somewhere that the Democrats spent a bunch of money trying to make sure that didn't happen, and it looks like it's money well spent.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the 49th Congressional District, where Issa now is the incumbent who's retiring, the number one vote-getter was Diane Harkey. She had about 26% of the vote. And then the next three candidates are all Democrats. And so one of them, most likely Mike Levin, an environmental attorney, is going to get into the runoff against Harkey in November. And, you know, similar in the 39th district where Ed Royce is retiring, the Republican came in first with about 22%, but not too far behind the Democrats' preferred choice, the Democratic Party, I should say, Gil Cisneros, had a little more than 19%. He is a mega lottery winner who is shown that he's more than willing to invest some of his money in his candidacy. So he'll be a well-funded candidate for the fall election.
Did any Republican perceived to be vulnerable do better than expected? Because I noticed that Steve Knight in the 25th and Mimi Walters in the 45th both finished with about 53% of the vote. And Steve Knight, it's my understanding that Democrats see him as very vulnerable, but getting 53% is, you know, certainly a good sign for the Republican.
It is, but as you well know, the turnout in the primary is very different from the turnout in the general. The fall turnout we would expect is going to be younger. It's going to be less white and more people of color voting, perhaps more Latinos. And so that should favor Democrats. So you can't read too much into the numbers from Tuesday night. That said, yeah, there are, I think of one Republican in particular, Jeff Denham, who is not that far from the Bay Area. His district went for Hillary Clinton. He was thought to be fairly vulnerable, but he did very well last night. He got more than twice as many votes as the number two person. He has been leading the charge on DACA, a vote on DACA. He's been opposing some of the leadership on that, and I think it's helped him in that district with some more moderate Republicans and maybe some voters who supported Hillary Clinton. So, yeah, there was that race. And David Valadao, also a Republican from that part of California, the Central Valley, where, you know, you look at the registration numbers and Democrats have an advantage and you'd think they would be very competitive. And it's just those are tough seats for the Democrats, in part because so many of the voters are Latino and they tend to vote in presidential elections, but much less likely to vote in midterms, you know, especially primaries. So we'll see if those gaps narrow come November. It is a tough, heavy lift for Democrats to win those seats.
You know, you mentioned Jeff Denham and David Valadao. These are two Republicans in the same state as Kevin McCarthy and Devin Nunes, who are staunch Trump allies and would probably want nothing to do with a DACA vote or a Dreamers vote. And that shows a split in the Republican Party.
It does. But, you know, it sort of reminds me of these Democrats like Connor Lamb, who ran against Nancy Pelosi
in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Do what you have to do to get elected, yeah. You know. And so I think that probably McCarthy, although, yes, you're right, he wasn't happy about that vote, he also realized, I'm sure, that it's good politics for Denham and Valadao. So he didn't, you know, try to punish them or anything like that. And it seems that they did benefit from that yesterday.
We talk about Tuesday, right. We talk about Republicans who may have done better than expected. Rohrabacher, on the other hand, finished with 30% in his open primary. Now, again, we don't know what that means as we talk about November, but coming in with 30% in a primary where the Republicans probably had their best shot,
Yeah, I think, you know, the other Republican in that race was pretty well known in that district, Scott Baugh, and that's one of the people that the DCCC did ads against to kind of pull his numbers down. That seems to have worked. But you're right. I mean, 30% of the vote for an incumbent. He is, by the way, the congressman that Kevin McCarthy, I think jokingly, said was Putin's favorite congressman. He's very pro-Russia and a bit iconoclastic, pro marijuana before legalization was really more of a mainstream issue. So we'll see if he's vulnerable. He certainly looks like it.
Let's go to the Senate race for a second. You know, for so much of the year, we were talking about how vulnerable Senator Dianne Feinstein was. You know, she was willing to accommodate with the Republicans. She turns 85 years old in 2 weeks. She supports the death penalty. She's not angry enough. I think that was the big criticism that the progressives had about her, that she wasn't angry enough in a year when so many Democrats are angry at President Trump. And yet, in the primary, or at least on Tuesday's results, she walloped her opponent from the left, Kevin DeLeon.
Yeah, she really did. I mean, I think what angered so many Democrats, and which really propelled Kevin DeLeon to get into that race, was comments that Feinstein made in, I think it was late August of last year. She was doing an onstage conversation in San Francisco, and she said, you know, we have to give President Trump some time. You know, I hope he can change. I hope he can be a good president. That's my wish. And that was not a message Democrats wanted to hear. But she's, you know, she hit the reset button after that. She saw the outcry. She has become much more vocally opposed to Trump and his nominees for the courts and for his cabinet. She's also moved to the left on issues like capital punishment. You know, she began her career in a way when she ran for governor in 1990. She went to the Democratic State Party convention and said she was for the death penalty. She got booed by the delegates and she made a commercial. You know, she sort of wore it on her sleeve, so to speak. But she has moved to the left on that, as well as on marijuana, on health care. So she's trying to limit the differences on policies between her and the more liberal Kevin DeLeon.
And is it fair to say that DeLeon has a very uphill battle for November?
Yes, it is. I would say he's going to need an elevator even to get to the hill he's got to climb. You know, he barely made second place. He was almost beaten by a Republican who is virtually unknown in California. So, who is going to put money on a horse that is so far back as the race begins? It's going to be tough for him to raise money. If you're not raising money, you're not on TV. If you're not on TV, voters don't know about you. And Feinstein's approval ratings, although there was concern about her age, and there was some concern about her not being anti-Trump enough. Clearly, if you look at the results last night, she has responded to those concerns. She won every single one of California's 58 counties.
And it looks like for the second time in a row, the California Senate race will not include a Republican candidate in November.
Yeah, just like last time when Kamala Harris ran off against a Democrat, Loretta Sanchez. Kamala Harris won, of course. And, you know, again, looks like we will have two Democrats come November. But, you know, Republicans are breathing a sigh of relief because they do at least have one candidate at the top of the ticket running for governor.
That governor's race, I thought, was very interesting. First of all, once upon a time, we thought it would be between Gavin Newsom, the lieutenant governor, who did finish first as expected, but also running against Antonio Villaraigosa, the former L.A. mayor, who was supposed to have this coalition of Latinos and strong votes from Southern California, and that didn't materialize.
It didn't materialize. I mean, there was not a huge or unusually big turnout of Latino voters. I believe Newsom even beat him in Los Angeles, his own county. Yeah. And so, you know, he got a lot of money spent on his behalf from charter school advocates. But, you know, it wasn't really clear what his message was. He tried to run to the right of Gavin Newsom on immigration, on criminal justice reform, on health care, and voters just weren't buying it. Democrats certainly, you know, overwhelmingly preferred Gavin Newsom, and he just couldn't pick up enough, you know, no party preference or more moderate Dems or moderate Republicans. And he ended up really just not being in the running at the end.
And it seems like both Gavin Newsom and the Republican Party got what they wanted, because Newsom clearly wanted to run against a Republican. He didn't want to run against a fellow Democrat. So he ran against John. He's going to run against John Cox, which is good news for him. But it's also good news for the Republican Party, because now they have somebody at the top of the ticket who theoretically could help those vulnerable House Republicans in November.
Yeah, it was interesting because, you know, sort of establishment Democrats like Nancy Pelosi really would have preferred a runoff with Newsom and Villaraigosa to turn down, to depress the turnout of Republican voters in the fall. And so there was a bit of a split. You know, some accused Newsom of caring more about his own election than about the national prospects for Democrats taking over the House. But, you know, candidates are in it to win it. And clearly he thought that he would have a much more easy race against a Republican than he would against Antonio Villaraigosa. And I'm sure that's true. I mean, Villaraigosa would really, I think, have given Newsom a real run for his money.
You know, this is not a race that I especially cover, but I thought this was interesting and worth a mention, too, that voters recalled that judge who sentenced the Stanford student who sexually assaulted an unconscious woman to just 6 months in jail. He was recalled.
He was, Aaron Persky, and that was a case where women in particular were outraged at the verdict and the sentence that was handed down. They felt that Brock Turner, a white, sort of privileged student at Stanford, getting a lighter sentence than others, say a person of color, would have gotten. And so they mobilized. It was a Stanford law professor, actually, who mobilized that campaign, got it on the ballot, and 60% or so of voters voted to recall Persky, the first judge in California recalled by the voters for many, many years. And so, you know, I think people who opposed it are worried that it could be a precedent, that it could encourage other judges to be challenged on the basis of a ruling that somebody or other doesn't like. We've seen it happen from the other direction on the right, say in Iowa, when their state Supreme Court justices came out in favor of gay marriage many years ago, and they got recalled. So, you know, it works both ways. And I think that there is a concern that by recalling a judge over a decision you don't like, you run the risk of politicizing the judiciary.
Where's Rose Byrd when we need her?
Yes.
In the end of everything, what's your big takeaway from California's primary results?
Well, a big takeaway is that for all the talk of the top two primary really scrambling everything, we're going to have a fairly traditional November election where almost all the races that we'll be watching carefully are going to have a Democrat and a Republican. That's true in the congressional races. It's true in the governor's race, not true in the Senate race. But by and large, that's what we're going to have. So maybe some of the concerns about that top two primary were a little overstated. So that's certainly one takeaway. And then I think the impact of Trump, you know, although he is very unpopular in many parts of California, he still, with all those Twitter followers, was able to signal the importance of turning out for John Cox, and it seems to have worked.
Scott Schaefer is a senior politics and government editor at radio station KQED in San Francisco. Scott, when do you get some sleep?
Well, probably maybe another few hours. I've got a few things to do, but, you know, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, Ken.
You know, on Thursday morning when you know, if you want, you could listen to this program and that could help.
You know, Thursday is my birthday and it's
no,
a big birthday.
No,
I'm not going to say which one, but it's a round one. So I may be listening to your show, but I'm hoping to be doing as little work as possible.
Well, happy birthday, Scott, and thanks so much for being on the show.
Anytime, Ken.
Spend my days with a woman unkind, smoke my stuff and drink all my wine. Made up my mind, make a new start, going to California with an aching in my heart.
Two of the greatest pastimes in this country have long been baseball and politics. Sometimes it's hard to tell them apart, with their similar focus on history and stats and trivia and lore. Oftentimes, politicians themselves talk about it. Here's Bobby Kennedy, the night he won the California primary in June of 68. This was the first thing he said, which may not have been totally serious, but it was certainly unexpected.
I want to express my high regard to Don Drysdale. Yeah! Who pitched his sixth straight shutout tonight. And I hope that we have his good fortune in our campaign.
That was the first thing Bobby said that night. Okay, back to the history of baseball. Ever since William Howard Taft Throughout the first ceremonial pitch on opening day in 1910, there's been a steady link between presidents and baseball. Perhaps the most memorable first pitch came not on opening day, but during Game 3 of the 2001 World Series, held at Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, just 6 weeks after the attacks of 9/11. The pitch came from President George W. Bush, wearing a bulletproof Fire Department of New York jacket. Here's the veteran Yankees public address announcer, the late Bob Shepard.
For tonight's ceremonial first pitch, and please welcome the President of the United States.
And as it was, Bush threw a perfect strike to the catcher.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Bush's memorable visit to Yankee Stadium is just one of the fabulous stories Kurt Smith writes about in his new book, The Presidents and the Pastime, The History of Baseball and the White House. He is a former Bush speechwriter as well as a baseball historian, and the combination works perfectly in this book. Kurt, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Well, Ken, thank you very much. I, too, share a great love of what I call America's twinning of the heart, these great two American institutions, the national office, the presidency, the national game, baseball. And, boy, what a pleasure it was researching and writing this book, because both have meant so much to me and I know to you, since quite literally it is the earliest days of my life. And, if you can repay even slightly what they have meant to both of us, I'm all for that.
Well, I should let the listeners know that just prior to us recording this interview, you and I had maybe a 15-minute conversation about baseball and politics, and oh my goodness, this book covers my two passions. I just wonder who might like this more, political junkies or baseball junkies.
Well, I don't know. You know, that's part of the charm. You can argue this at a bar, and many have, and probably many will. But that's part of the great allure. We all have an opinion, and by all, I mean, I think the great majority, not to be sexist, because women will be included in this as well, but the great majority of American men are brought up, find themselves transfixed by baseball and by politics. I think of two great communicators, two fascinating intellectuals, if you will, Mario Cuomo and Richard Nixon. Both loved politics, both loved baseball particularly. Cuomo played baseball in the Pittsburgh Pirates farm system as a pitcher before becoming injured and going to law school. And they both became friends in the last 10 years of Nixon's life. And they often talked about the similarities between the two. And if I could briefly summarize, that they were both competitive. They both demanded that you marshal all of the resources that you have. That would be mental and physical, often moral, spiritual, all that you have to offer during a long campaign or, let's say, the marathon of a baseball season. They were clear-cut. You knew at the end of an election or at the end of a baseball game who had won and lost and why. They both involved strategy. Or as Bush 43 would say, strategy. And they both were not exactly bereft of ego, if I may try to put it in the most gentle vein. So they were both consumed by these as well, Nixon and Cuomo.
Although I don't remember Cuomo calling the coach of a Super Bowl team, calling it a play, right, as Nixon did with George Allen and the Redskins.
That's very true. But Allen had been the football coach at Whittier College, which was Nixon's alma mater, so perhaps that was one qualifying factor as well. But, they were both lifelong baseball fans and true connoisseurs of the sport.
When I think of presidents in baseball, I think everybody knows that William Howard Taft threw out the ceremonial for his pitch. But were presidents involved in the game before then?
Well, they were to an extent. Washington, before there was a presidency, he was General George Washington, at Valley Forge, played baseball, that is, rounders, which was a British antecedent of the game, with an aide-de-camp for hours, strategizing in his own mind about where the war would go from there. You go to the early 1860s, Abraham Lincoln, there are many records of episodes in the book of him playing town ball, a derivative of baseball, on the South Lot, as it was then called. We call it the Lips, where the National Christmas Tree is. And he would play town ball outside for hours. He would bring the game inside the White House, if you can imagine, and use the corridors for base paths. And there are accounts of Lincoln, all 6 foot, 4 inches of him, flying down the corridor. Now, I don't think he was necessarily timed from home plate to first base because the game wasn't exactly formalized at that point. But the point of a larger sense is how deeply rooted baseball is in the nation's past.
But when you think of playing baseball in the White House, I mean, wasn't Nixon caught stealing? Okay, I'm sorry.
Well,
that was so cheap.
That depends. Depends on your affiliation.
Right. Well, you know something, you mentioned Washington, and this is in your book, and I've read this before, but I love this so much. In Henry Lee's eulogy of President Washington, he said, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, right? So tell me about what they said about the Washington Senators.
Oh, well, of course, it's one of the great adages in sports history. First in war, first in peace, and last in the American League. And as Dizzy Dean would say, Podna, you ain't just a woofin'. They earn last place on merit. To an extent, as I say in the book, that the late great announcer Bob Wolf, who did the Senators from 1946 and 60, used to tell me tongue-in-cheek, I think he was kidding, that whenever he was broadcasting the Senators, he would simply, during the course of a baseball game, people tuning in from time to time, would just hear him give the score, 10 to 2, 4, 6 to 4, 13 to 1. He wouldn't necessarily at all say who was ahead. He said people tuning in knew who was winning, and it wasn't the Senators.
Yeah.
That's how bad the Senators were.
Well, if you look at the fights between Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer, the Senators are not doing so well this time either. Listen, I know that George Bush Sr., you know, president number 41,
yes,
he played baseball at Yale in the 1940s. He was the team captain. Is there a president who is considered, whom you consider to be the best baseball player of all the presidents?
Well, I'm biased a tad, except I try, I hope valiantly and successfully in this book to be dispassionate, bipartisan, nonpartisan. The reader will decide. But, of course, I worked for Bush 41 for the entirety of his term from 1989 through 93 and then headed his speech staff for the following 4 years. He's a marvelous human being, as the country knows by now. And he told me that... I once asked him why he loved baseball, and he paused for a moment and he said, baseball has everything, which Ken's a wonderfully succinct three-word inscription of baseball's allure. And I asked him when he first came to this grasp, and he said, oh, the first time I ever swung a wooden baseball bat. And I said, when was that? He said, oh, when I turned 5. He's now 94, about to turn 94, and still in love with the game. And he's played it, he's coached it. Barbara Bush, his late wife, carpooled kids to baseball games, Bush said, all over the state of Texas, slight hyperbole. And I know from talking to Bush dozens of times about baseball over the years that it was deeply embedded in the Bush family. But to your question, yes, I think he is definitely the best baseball player, the best athlete ever to become president. This is a man who came back from World War II, became captain of his baseball team at Yale, was a stunning fielder. And the statistics support me on this, which I cite in the book. He couldn't hit a lick, as he freely admitted, but then that's a problem that, that's a problem that thwarted many of us, including yours truly. But there is footage of him, video, in his 60s, making spectacular stops behind sprawling behind first base, getting up, racing to the bag ahead of the runner. So he kept himself in great shape and has. But yes, he was a marvelous fielder. And a scout told me, Major League scout, that had there been a position called designated fielder at the time, along with designated hitter, that Bush easily would have made the bigs as a designated fielder. He was a marvelous baseball player.
You know, on the cover of your book, we see President Franklin Roosevelt standing up and throwing out a ball.
Yeah.
Was there a reason you picked FDR for the cover?
How could I not? He was the spine of the book, quite literally. This is a man who saved the game. That is not hyperbolic. It's based upon fact. He, of course, served from 1933 through his death in 1945. He helped us win the war. He helped save the world. That, too, is not hyperbolic. He also saved baseball. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, baseball typically was clueless. It didn't know whether it should operate in 1942. And by baseball, I mean organized baseball, the majors and also the minor leagues. Didn't know whether it should operate in 42 or indeed during at any time during the remaining duration of the war, no matter how long that would be until hopefully total victory. So Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the commissioner, wrote a letter to Roosevelt saying, in essence, we are at your mercy. Tell us what to do. The next day, January 15th, 1942, Roosevelt sent a letter to Landis. Moreover, Ken, this shows the stunning importance of baseball then to the United States of America. Franklin D. Roosevelt read the entirety of his letter to the Commissioner of Baseball at his White House press conference. And what he said was this, not simply that I hope baseball will play. He, in essence, instructed baseball to play for the duration of the war. He said it's important to the morale of the home front, and he said that next to letters from loved ones here at home, what would improve the morale of troops abroad more than anything would be box scores and game accounts in newspapers from home. Bingo. Franklin Roosevelt knew his country, and he knew his game. He saved baseball. And in fact, I catalog in the chapter on Franklin Roosevelt, every president has a chapter on him, beginning with Theodore Roosevelt, going through Donald Trump. And in the Roosevelt chapter, I catalog how he saved the game, how people at the time understood that he saved the game, and why Franklin Roosevelt deserves to be inducted posthumously by the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown. There are nearly 300 plaques of players and executives who have been inducted at Cooperstown. Not one of them, Ken, merits the phrase or has a phrase on his plaque, saved baseball. Franklin Roosevelt saved baseball.
What is it, do you think, about presidents and baseball that we don't find with other sports like basketball or football?
Well, it's a game of individual, for one, and it's a game of history for the other. I think it's almost impossible for someone to be elected president without understanding the gravity of the office, without understanding the consequences that rest upon him, and without being interested and transfixed, frankly, by predecessors. What decisions did they make? What were they faced with? How did they confront this crisis or that? And this lends itself naturally to favoring baseball over other sports. I mean, the history of baseball in this country, I would suggest, dwarfs all other sports combined. So if you're president, how could you not be impressed by that?
As a Yankees fan, I know I get boos about that a lot. But as a Yankees fan,
well, as a Red Sox fan.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just accidentally hung up on you. I'm so sorry. No, never.
Please proceed.
Well, look, I'd rather you be a Red Sox fan than not like baseball.
True, very true.
Anyway, but as a Yankees fan, one of my favorite presidential baseball stories is, of course, the George W. Bush visit to Yankee Stadium. So this is, you know, memories of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center are still raw. And, of course, a lot of the night was about politics. But it was about baseball, too. And this is what fascinates me reading this in your book. It's about baseball and pride. Townhall.com released this great video of separate interviews with Bush as well as Yankee shortstop Derek Jeter. I want to play that now.
You know, I want to make sure that if I was going to throw out the ball, I was able to do so with a little zip. You know, I didn't want people to think that their president was incapable of finding the plate. So I go underneath the Yankee Stadium, in the bowels of Yankee Stadium, and there's a hitting cage there.
And then Derek Jeter comes up to him.
So I just asked him if he was going to be throwing the first pitch from the mound or in front of the mound. And I told him, you better throw it from the mound, otherwise you're going to get booed. I said, this is Yankee Stadium.
I said, okay, I'll throw from the mound. And he's walking out, and he looks over his shoulder, and he says, don't bounce it. They'll boo you. And so the pressure all of a sudden, I mean, I'm sitting there kind of fairly relaxed and feeling fairly loose, and the great Derek Jeter, don't bounce it. They'll boo you. And all of a sudden, the pressure mounted.
The President of the United States.
Kurt, I love that story.
Well, that story is in the book. And I have the exchange between Jeter and Bush 43 in what Bush called the magnificent undercarriage of Yankee Stadium, a lovely term. And he followed the advice of Derek Jeter, which shows some good common sense there, because, of course, of what had happened the prior month. And the wounds that were still rubbed raw in New York, because this had been the epicenter, of course, of the terrorism, and the people that had been lost, and many personally that people at the ballpark knew. And, of course, what was interesting to me, I had not known this. I don't think many people do. Unbelievably, given how many World Series your team has been in and hosted at the big ballpark in the Bronx.
As they should.
This was the first American president ever to attend a World Series game at Yankee Stadium. Amazing. And Bush just rose to the occasion. That night, as I wrote in the presidents in the past time, he came closer to being a hero than he had ever been before or ever would be again. It was a stunning, gallant, noble performance.
You know, I wish there was a video of this interview, because I am so excited talking about these two subjects, because I have such passion for both politics and baseball. And I don't even know if I could answer this question that I'm about to ask you. But
oh, I think I know what it is, and I don't have an answer.
Well, do you prefer one over the other?
No. And I knew that was the question. I don't. How's that for decisiveness?
Yeah, you'd be great in politics. John Kerry would be very proud of you.
This is an honest dodge, as opposed to their dishonest dodges. If I had to give one up, including the reading of entirely about the subject, I would probably give up politics.
I think I would too.
Simply because the reading of baseball history to me is so part of my life. It's what I grew up on, even before I read political history.
Kurt Smith is the author of a wonderful new book, The Presidents and the Pastime, The History of Baseball and the White House. Kurt, I can't begin to tell you what a pleasure it was having this conversation.
Thank you so much.
The crack of the bat, the stadium's roar. We were up on our feet for the tie-breaking score. I said, Daddy, I know what you brought me here for. He said, good, I hoped you'd hear the call. Life's a fastball, belt high, coming right down the middle. Don't stand there and let it go by. Swing hard and aim for the stand.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, aside from Richard Nixon, who was the most recent president who served in the House and Senate, as well as vice president? The answer, Lyndon Johnson. A Democrat from Texas, he won a special House election in 1937 and served until 1948, when he was elected to the Senate. He stayed in the Senate until 1960, when he was elected vice president on the ticket led by John F. Kennedy. He became president in 1963 after Kennedy's assassination. And the winner is Dennis Fricks of Fenton, Missouri. Dennis wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the political junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Hello, Lyndon. Well, hello, Lyndon. It's just great to have you there where you belong. You're looking swell, Lyndon. We can tell, Lyndon.
You're still glowing, you're still growing, you're still going strong.
We hear the band playing and the folks saying,
you're the man who knows just how to get things done. So
it's time for This Week in Political History. This week, of course, is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy. We've covered that tragic event in several episodes over the past 2 years, notably with Kennedy biographer Larry Tye about his new book in 2016, and earlier this year in part one of our 1968 special. It was in the early hours of June 5th, 1968, when Kennedy had declared victory over Senator Eugene McCarthy in a tough Democratic presidential primary in California. And he was talking about what was to come.
What I think is quite clear is that we can work together in the last analysis, and that what has been going on within the United States over the period of the last 3 years, the divisions, the violence, the disenchantment with our society, the divisions, whether it's between blacks and whites, between the poor and the more affluent, or between age groups, or on the war in Vietnam, that we can start to work together. We are a great country, and a selfish country, and a compassionate country. And I intend to make that my basis for running and over the period of the next few months.
And then, his final words.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there. Thank you very much.
As I said earlier in the program, so much of the last day of Senator Robert Kennedy's political career and his life has been reviewed on this program before, but I'm not sure actually what else there is to say. But I just learned that Jack Oman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for the Sacramento Bee and a good friend, attended Senator Kennedy's burial at Arlington National Cemetery 50 years ago this week. Jack, at the time, was a young boy there with his parents, and he's on the show to share his memories. Jack, thanks a lot for being on The Political Junkie once again.
Thanks, Ken. I just want to say last night on June 5th in California, in Sacramento, I hosted a remembrance of Senator Kennedy and with Mark Grossman, who was Cesar Chavez's press secretary, and a professor, Joe Palermo, at Sacramento State. And we had close to 200 people there. And I would say about a quarter of the audience had some sort of contact with RFK in Sacramento or in California during the primary. And many of them got up and shared their personal stories, and it was incredibly poignant.
You know, it's one thing to talk about what actually happened. It's another to talk to the people who were there, who had memories of it, who were somehow involved with the campaign or with Senator Kennedy. And the anguish you hear from these voices have not dimmed even in 50 years passing.
Well, there were people weeping last night who were telling their stories. You know, they were 10, 13 years old or 24 years old, and they had, one guy had driven Kennedy in a motorcade in San Francisco, and, you know, no Secret Service, you know, people tearing his cufflinks off, taking his shoes off, and to hear somebody who was actually there telling these incredibly vivid stories was incredibly moving.
Now, I know in 1968, you were a young kid. Were you a political kid?
At the time, not really. I was attuned to it in the way that a lot of kids were, whose parents watched the nightly news and got the newspaper and got Time and Life magazine and Look magazine. And so I was familiar with this. And I do remember Kennedy announcing on March 16th, and my mother came out, and it was a beautiful sunny day in Marquette, Michigan. And she said, "Bobby's running." And I didn't know that she had any particular interest in him. And, you know, a seven-year-old has a rather limited worldview, but I certainly knew who he was and who President Kennedy was. And so a couple of weeks after that, my parents moved to Washington, D.C., and Marquette, Michigan is a very isolated place and still is. It's up on the UP. I had never seen a black person before, to my knowledge, in Marquette, Michigan. And so I went to D.C. and several days later, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And so my father was a history buff, and we used to go to all the Civil War battlefields around there. And I remember seeing dozens of spires of brown and black smoke coming from the Washington, D.C. skyline. And then I believe it was 7 weeks later, Senator Kennedy was shot.
Now, let me ask you, so obviously there was a family decision to go to the burial site at Arlington National Cemetery. Is that correct?
Yeah. So my father said early that evening we were going to go over to Arlington and see this. And so we parked down in the Theodore Roosevelt Memorial Island, which is down in the Potomac. And I remember walking what seemed like endless distances in this very heavy brown twilight, the mugginess of Washington. And tens of thousands of people were streaming over these hills to go into the gates at Arlington National Cemetery to see this. And I you know, that sort of thing would never be allowed now. But it was just people were going over the fence and through the gates. And so we walked up.
There was no security or anything like that?
No. Not that I was able to tell. I mean, I wasn't attuned to that. All I knew is that there were just these huge throngs of people walking in the twilight. And so we walked up. And if you've been to Arlington, it's not a long walk from the one gate up to the Kennedy gravesite. And one thing that struck me was you could see the TV lights. And so by the time we got up to the very close to the TV lights, it was dark. And not only were there people coming in, they had coolers. Like, I remember so many people were carrying coolers. And we sat down. I doubt we were 100 and some feet from the gravesite because the TV lights were so bright. It would probably be at that intersection right before you would turn up to the Kennedy grave. And so there was a black woman sitting on a cooler next to us, and President Johnson drove by, and she said, my mother said, "Oh my God, it's Lyndon Johnson." And the woman said, "I don't give a damn about him. I just want to see Bobby." And seconds later, the hearse pulled up behind the president, and I believe, and I remember so vividly the brilliant colors of the flag draped coffin, which were hyper illuminated by these TV lights and by flashbulbs. I remember flashbulbs, you remember, and just boom, 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 and everybody had an Instamatic or something. And I remember seeing Ethel Kennedy, and I'm quite certain I saw Jacqueline Kennedy. And so the limousine pulled, or the hearse pulled up, and everybody got out, and we just stood there. And I don't know how long it was we stood there. I mean, it could have been an hour. It could have been a half an hour. I'm not sure. There's no, like, endpoint to this, other than I remember walking back to the car with my father, and it was the first time I'd ever talked to my father about death. And he was dumbfounded, almost. And he was a scientist, and so imagine that, the trauma that the family went through, the trauma that the American people went through, where they're trying to explain yet another assassination to their children. Now, I mean, it's so hard to register with people now, but that the King-Kennedy thing was just, you know, virtually simultaneous. That people just picked themselves off the ground after the King assassination. And then this happens.
Just 2 months earlier. And the Bobby... The Bobby gravesite was just 30 yards away from Jack's gravesite, which is another haunting thought.
It was incredibly poignant.
Let me shift gears for just a second. I understand you have a new book on the 1968 Oregon primary. This is the one that took place just a week before the crucial California contest. And it was the primary where Senator Eugene McCarthy defeated Robert Kennedy, the first election defeat ever suffered by the Kennedy family. What do we learn from your book? What is, again, also 50 years ago? Let me just point out that when you talk about your history with Oregon, for years, you were the editorial cartoonist at the Portland Oregonian.
Right, for 28 years. Almost 40 years later, I got a phone call from Ethel Kennedy, and I had won the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award for my cartoons in Oregon. And I had been thinking about him. When you enter a contest, you just forget about it, and then if you win, you hear. But to pick up the phone and have been thinking about Robert Kennedy, she said, congratulations, you know, you've won the cartoon contest and the RFK, and Bobby would be proud of you, or you honor Bobby's memory. And I cannot tell you how profoundly moving that was to have that. And then I said, Mrs. Kennedy, I don't know if people do this or not. I just wanted to tell you, and I apologize for this in advance, but I wanted to tell you that I went to the burial. And she was very moved by that. And she said, no, it's okay. It keeps his memory alive. And when children or, you know, adults tell me that they've met Bobby, it's good for me. So that was, to me, the main takeaway.
Jack Ohman is the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for the Sacramento Bee, who attended Bobby Kennedy's burial at Arlington National Cemetery on June 8, 1968, 50 years ago this week. Jack, thank you so much for sharing your memories.
Thank you, Ken.
You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
Time it was, and what a time it was, it was. A time of innocence, a time of confidences. Long ago, it must be, I have a photograph. Preserve your memories, they're all that's left you.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.